With the state of today's economy, it's more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made from the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back in your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality, made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
There was ever a case study in manipulation, delusion, and the dangers of unchecked charisma, Charles Manson is it. He was a failed musician, a career criminal, and yet somehow managed to convince a group of young people to kill for him, all while barely lifting a finger. How does someone like Manson hold that kind of power? And more importantly, what makes people follow him to such horrific extremes? Today, we're diving into the psychology of Charles Manson with psychotherapist Siobhan Scott. Siobhan, in your professional opinion, was Manson a master manipulator who knew exactly what he was doing? Or was he simply a product of his own delusions, a man who truly believed his own madness and found some weak-minded people to go along with it?
Well, if you needed a criminal guru, white supremacist, pop musician, all in one, there was Charlie. And, you know, fortunately, we don't see a lot like him, which is wonderful, which is why he's still infamous at this point, all these decades later. There were a lot of evaluations done on him early on, and I reviewed summaries of those. He was early on determined not to be psychotic. He was diagnosed with extreme personality disorders. Guess which ones? Psychopathy and narcissism. And even though he had these sort of delusional thoughts about helter-skelter, race wars, you know, these kind of paranoid themes, he could put them on when they were useful to him, and he could drop them when it wasn't useful. So he was seen primarily by the people who evaluated him as highly manipulative, cunning, Machiavellian, and he knew how to target vulnerable people. And so he really was very good at manipulating. Now, he didn't manipulate everybody because a lot of people saw him and ran the other way. But he was able to draw in this young group, particularly young women, who were very vulnerable, who were cast-off people, who were lost. Many of them were homeless runaways. And he knew how to give them what they were needing, which was a sense of family. And then there was the copious use of LSD, which altered people's perceptions, which also made them more vulnerable. And he was just really a walking nightmare, very good at what he did.
And that's the big question is, why was he so good at what he did? What traits did he possess with these people that made him so effective? Because on the surface, you look at this guy, and if you have a healthy brain, you go, it's nuts. But to some people, they went, he's our leader. He's the best thing on earth. How can two people have such dramatically different views on one person? And how does that person speak to the one group and not the other with what they're presenting, and have be so effective with one and not with another?
There were so many gurus at the time. Now, I don't think you were alive.
No.
In 1967.
I was not.
I was a very young child, I'll say, but I was alive then. the whole country was reeling with the Vietnam War, violent protests, shootings on college campuses by the National Guard. It was a crazy time. I remember being a little kid and watching the TV news at night. You had the Zodiac Killer. You had a lot of serial killers were active at that time, certainly much more so than now. And there were lots of people who were lost, and particularly in San Francisco, where Charlie was based in that part of California, you had, it was like a magnet for very confused, drug-addled young people. And these were the people that he preyed upon. And there were lots of weird gurus around at the time who had followings. He just happened to be the more insidious, violent one.
Very interesting. And yeah, the society and where things are at, all that context is so important to try and understand where things are at. That's such a key thing for something like this. Let's talk about how he was able to get these young people that were searching for home, that were searching for, you know, some sort of identity for who they are, and they found it in this group of his followers. And there was a lot of them. There was a lot of people that were under the spell of Charles Manson. I guess, there's obviously large cults out there. We see them. But to have all these people basically under one roof and nobody going, this seems a little odd. Charlie's kind of suggesting we go kill somebody over here. Mm-hmm. To go from, oh, this is warmth, this is family, now I want you to go kill. You know, it looks really spooky when you put Charles Manson in that frame, but it really is gang culture as well, where it's like, mm-hmm. prove your allegiance to the gang and go do something horrible to somebody that doesn't deserve it. It happens. I mean, one could argue that gang culture is similar as well. It may be cult-like in certain aspects, not
very
completely,
much.
but it's really, it's spookier when it's the creepy looking guy bringing all the attractive women in versus, you know, the ghetto and its gang members.
Yeah, 100%. And that shows the danger of humans in large groups and the damage that can be done. I mean, it's simply a fact that you get a group of people isolated from the external factors, you know, from their families, from other people, and they reinforce each other with some very dangerous beliefs and behavior. It even brings to mind military culture for me. You know, my husband was in the military for 13 years. I don't want to knock the military here, but you can get soldiers to commit absolute atrocities against innocent people. We see this throughout history.
Yeah.
You know, going back to the 60s in Vietnam, there was the My Lai massacre, where entire villages of people, old people, children, babies, people were just massacred, and they were no threat to anyone. They weren't part of the enemy, you know?
Yeah.
And so we see that people in large groups who get fired up, who get this us versus them mentality, people who are not normally violent people, can just sort of go crazy and do awful atrocities because somebody is telling them to.
What's the tipping point, though? I mean, is it different for everybody where you're going to be, okay, I'm hearing this guy out, I believe in it, but now he's saying I'm going to kill, like, that's a bit much, but... Is it the repetition? I mean, how does it get so normalized that you can get people to go and do those sort of things? And is there any coming back from it once you get to that point?
It's really hard to know. Are any of us vulnerable to this sort of thing? I don't think so. I think people with a very strong inner moral compass, a strong character, I can't see you being influenced in that way. You know, you certainly have a healthy ego, but there are people who are, you know, we talk a lot about critical thinkers. There are people who aren't very good at it, and they do tend to be followers. So do those people tend to group together under these kind of malevolent leaders? I think that's probably it. You've just got a different kind of person that will go along with that. And other people filter themselves out of that kind of a group much sooner, or they never join in the first place.
How about getting out of it, like once you're in there? Obviously, we have seen some of Manson followers just last year, I forget which one, but up for parole. I don't remember what happened there, honestly, off the top of my head, if she was granted it or not. But claiming, you know, okay, I've changed, I've reformed, I saw the error in what the hell happened back then. But does anyone truly ever come back from that once you got there? And are they still a type of person that's going to be susceptible to that? Or are you stronger after you've survived that, if you've come out the other side going, well, that was messed up, to not ever have to worry about falling into that again?
Yeah, I think it's probably hard to know in advance. It's a case-by-case basis. Mm-hmm. But I remember, I believe it was Leslie Van Houten who was up for parole. And one of the things that they look for on whether they let someone out, I don't think they did let her out, but one of the things that they look for is, does this person have insight? Do they have understanding that they can articulate in their own words about why they got into that situation, what went wrong, and what have they learned since then? And I remember being somewhat impressed with her testimony, that the woman did really seem to fully own what she had done, but also have a great deal of understanding about what went wrong and what she had learned since. So I think that when people are out of that kind of group, and their thinking returns to normal and they grow, I do like to believe, even though I can come off very cynical based upon my work history, I do like to believe that there's hope for many people, right? Maybe not everybody, but many people. And so that's one of the other determinants. Was this person psychotic? Well, when they get out of the group, do they let go of those strange beliefs? And so I think most of these followers, some may have been psychotic themselves, but I think many were not. And it was just a function of this cult mentality that they were immersed in that made them perceive the world in such a distorted way that they would do horrible things.
And Van Houten actually was released last year, July 11th.
Okay.
Is when she was, I completely forgot about all that.
There hasn't been any news about her, so maybe she's keeping a very low profile.
Well, I think she started a new cult, and it's called Amway. She's selling Amway, and she's a Mormon. It's a double trouble type thing going on. Let's talk about Manson and kind of what made him who he is. What's the recipe? Obviously, there was some abuse in his childhood, and you know, that certainly is part of the recipe. But what do you think made him who he was and enabled him to have the power that he ended up having over people?
Yeah. Very, very bad combination of genetics and environment. And, you know, he probably came into the world with certain kinds of vulnerabilities for psychopathy, which we know is a biological condition. The person's brain is actually different. They don't have an functional empathy center where they have compassion for other people. And then you put that kind of instability where he was left with relatives very early on when his mother went to prison, and then a series of institutions and reform schools where he was raped and assaulted in various ways. You end up with a very warped human being. So, as I say, we don't see a lot like him, fortunately. And this was just a really, really bad combination of life experience combined with genetics.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, was he born this way? I mean, there's certainly probably elements that he was, but, you know, and that that all just played into this perfect storm of what Charles Manson ended up being.
Yeah, maybe with the genetics and a very positive family upbringing, he could have been a CEO with all that manipulative skill.
Yeah,
but not a crazy guru LSD, you know, rattled mass murderer.
What I mean, the fact that, you know, he was in prison for many, many years and basically still was Charles Manson. He never really changed all that much, just kind of got deeper and deeper into his beliefs. Was that, when you look back on that retrospectively, obviously he's dead now. Was that surprising to you at all as a psychotherapist, or was that, you know, pretty much to be expected of someone who gets put into that sort of a setting? Because we see some where it's like they get reformed and okay, yeah, I was wrong, this was horrible, and all that. No, Charlie just kind of kept going as best he could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Charlie's personality was really set in concrete. And that's why when they did those evaluations of him, they really stressed the severity of his personality pathology and that it really, that kind of stuff is set very early in life and it's how the brain develops. So that's a person I would not expect any kind of therapy techniques or procedures, processes to have any real impact on.
Let's talk about drugs in this. LSD was a big thing, obviously, with this. And that new documentary, Chaos, which is on Netflix, goes into kind of presenting a different story on Manson, or a different theory on Manson, that it was more of, you know, he was basically part of a government experiment. And there was a lot of interesting coincidences, if you will. Interesting is probably the wrong word, but they were. Charlie just was kind of free to do a lot of what he wanted for quite a long time before anybody really, you know, looked into him on a serious level. With the drugs that he was doing with his followers, how can that affect the way of thinking? And did it cause like permanent damage to decision-making processes that also may have helped enable his followers to be in this group and yeah, maybe have a shared psychosis going on amongst themselves?
Yeah, LSD alters perceptions. I've never indulged, so mm-hmm. I only Me know either. What I hear from people and yeah. what I've read. But certainly in large quantities, it could, again, feed strange beliefs, strange behavior, reduce inhibitions, and alter brain chemistry in ways that are not going to be helpful to a person. So that's another disturbing aspect to this.
With when we look at him, and yes, we, you know, he's been diagnosed psychopath, narcissism, all that, and people like labels. So we'll talk about labels for a moment. Sociopath, psychopath, all of the above. Is he just like checking every box that was out there?
Yeah, I think he's got such a mix, and then you throw in some paranoid beliefs. It's drug, you know, drug damage. Mm-hmm. It's a really complex brain, a complex case. And all I can say is it's good that we don't see a lot of this going around.
Yeah, I mean, the way that society was at that tipping point, back at that point in time, it makes you wonder. I mean, there's a lot of unrest right now. There's a lot of people looking for belonging, looking for something to believe in. We see that in political movements. That seems to be kind of the more common one. We see it in ways that people group around interests in ways that they really couldn't have in the past. I mean, look at the true crime community. Look at the community for you name it. You know, people like to knit, whatever it may be. Okay. There's a community for it, and people can interact in ways that they never did in the past. Are we on a path, do you think, to see more of the guru culture come back the way it did at that point in time, with this longing that we have in our society for identity?
I think we see it playing out in our political system, whether mm-hmm. you're on the right or the left. There you can find people who function like cult leaders, right?
Yeah.
And that's of concern. We're not seeing a lot of critical thought. We're not looking at independent thought. And, you know, with the internet, I don't know, Tony, you could potentially become a cult leader at this point. You've got quite a following.
Thought of it.
Fortunately, you're just not psychopathic. You just have too much concern and compassion for people, which always comes through in your work.
Damn it.
But yeah, I think the potential is always there. We see it with religious groups. We talk a lot about that, you know, yeah. the daybells and how people really are looking for someone to give them a story, a narrative about reality, to give them a sense of belonging and to tell them what is the truth.
Wouldn't that be an interesting experiment? I've not seriously thought of it. It's more like after a couple glasses of wine going, What if he tried to start a cult? Just as a study, not like I really want to start a cult and make people do crazy things. Well, the crazy things might be kind of fun. Just nothing that's going to harm anyone. But just to see how easy it would be. Because, I don't know, watching these folks, it doesn't seem like it would be all that hard. Has anyone ever done that just to try and to go to a certain extent? Okay, tell me about that, because I've always wondered.
There is a fabulous documentary. It was on Netflix. It's been a few years back, so I don't know where you can find it now, but it's called Kumare, K-U-M-A-R-E. And it's a fascinating documentary because it's an Indian American man who decided he would try to start a cult and see who he could get. And he had cameras going the whole time because he was a documentarian. And so he went to India. He studied yoga. He let his hair grow out. He dressed up like a guru wearing the robes.
Yeah.
And he came back to the U.S. and he started going to, I think it was started off in yoga studios, but he would bill himself as the spiritual teacher from India. He put on the thick Indian accent and he immediately attracted followers. And he was spouting utter nonsense. And this is a comedy. I mean, it says so much about the human mind and the need to belong and the need to have a guru. But people ate it up. And before long, he had his own cult. And then the movie ended with him sitting everybody down and saying, "I'm a fake," and putting back on his normal American accent and saying, "This has all been a scam. I was just playing a game here." And people did not want to believe it.
Yeah.
And some people did. Some people were, you know, tearful and devastated by it and upset. And other people were like, "No, I still believe he changed my life." And I mean, it was just absolutely fascinating. One of my favorite films. I've probably seen it 10 times and I could watch it once a month and still get enjoyment out of it. Just because it shows this non-rational aspect and the need people have to believe and how they will follow someone who, because he was very warm and very loving to everyone. And because he met people's emotional needs, people swallowed it.
Yeah. And that's interesting because their emotional needs were being met. But it was through nonsense.
It was through utter nonsense.
Yeah.
And if he had been, he had women offering sex, I mean, which he did not take any money from anyone. But you certainly saw the potential that because he had this aura about him and he was charismatic and very loving, that people could have easily been exploited by him.
Is that how we get cult leaders? I mean, how they grow, how they continue to get more powerful and amass more, where obviously this guy knew he was making it up from the beginning.
Yeah.
And it was just like, let's see what happens, you know, a kind of an elevated way of thinking about this. But if you have someone, you know, like a Manson or I'm thinking almost more like a Lori Daybell, where they believe they're hearing these voices. They believe they're getting these messages from this higher power, or insert anybody here who thinks that way. And then they start to get people listening and believing that, oh gosh, your higher power told you this about me? Especially if they believe they're getting messages about other people to help other people, you start to amass that and you get more and more people really getting into you and believing you, that just reinforces your probably own belief that these messages are real, that
100%.
You do have this higher power that's reaching out to you. And I guess if you get so deep into it, you're in. You end up believing your own BS. Even at the beginning, even if you were questioning it, you would totally believe it. It would take like the Kumari thing where like, you know, flat out at the beginning, this is not real.
Right. Yeah, I think there is this feedback that just reinforces the belief. And the more people are given because it elevates their sense of self-esteem to be given this positive feedback about how they're helping people or how they're channeling, you know, angels. I mean, I have heard the strangest stories, right? And, you know, people get very seduced by this sense of power.
If the group is not out there actively harming other people or themselves, and they're not they're not about that. You know, some groups really, you know, that's kind of where it ends up going. Is it so wrong to be in a cult, a peaceful cult? I mean, I guess one would call that like a church, you know, or some churches, you know, where it's like we're feeding the poor, we're doing this or that, and it's good, and you're not harming anybody, and it is bringing you, you know, some sort of happiness in your life, fulfillment, even if it is. And I'm not saying religion is nonsense, but even if others look at it and go, this is nonsense. If it's doing that, like in the Kamari, where if these people are finding that fulfillment, even though it's BS, is it wrong? Is it bad?
I know.
Is that a, is that a horrible thing? If this is someone who's already out there searching for it and they find it in some way that somebody is offering this, is that a bad thing?
This is such a good topic. This is such a good topic because it's a gray area, isn't it? It's like when people's beliefs are comforting them, offering them a sense of hope, a sense of purpose. It's hard to criticize it other than can it go south at some point? Mm-hmm. And we certainly see enough cases where it turns ugly because somebody in a position of leadership takes it in a dark direction. I don't know. I have a bias in favor of reality. I'm really invested in reality myself because I grew up in a weird religion and figured it out by 18 that this was a lot of bunk and it was not serving me in any way. In fact, it was making me make really stupid decisions. So I tend to have a bias toward reality. But I also understand the human need to feel better. Mm-hmm. And people are always looking for ways to feel soothed and comforted and connected to other people. And I guess it's one of those gray areas that, you know, that we just hope people stay mindful of is this whatever I'm involved in, is it really serving me? Is it serving the people around me? Or is it turning into something ugly?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost... it's like artificial flavoring, you know? where it's like, I really like the fresh strawberries, but if all I can get is the flavor of it, then okay. You know, there might be red dye number 5 in here that may give me cancer, but it meets that need right now.
Yes.
So it's almost like a mental band-aid, I would say, in some ways, where it doesn't truly fulfill the person to the level where it's sustainable and long lasting, but it's filling that need right now. Just the same way. I mean, it's probably the same way, you know, drugs work and alcohol works. It fulfills need at that moment, except it's all 100% psychological. You're still getting the same dopamine hits and everything. It's just a matter of how you're basically evoking that out of yourself.
100%. Yeah, I look at it as a defense mechanism, a coping strategy, and most of the time these faith systems are benign and stay benign. Mm-hmm. But you can look at people who contribute a huge chunk of their income to mega church ministers who are becoming multimillionaires and wonder, you know, is this really helping people or is it exploiting them? There's all this gray area.
Yeah, I question that a lot. Like, especially like you watch like interviews and stuff with some of these people, like Joel Osteen, for example. Yeah. It's like you're sitting on a throne while like Barbara Walters is interviewing you. Like, literally, that's a throne. Like, that'd be in a castle. Like, you're a preacher. Like, I believe there's things in the actual Bible against this.
Right.
This exact principle of where, like, your house. Like, it's regal. It's insane.
Very much.
I'm not saying you can't be successful and have religion by any means, but it's the optics. It's what you're representing, and you're kind of going and doing the exact opposite of what you claim to be all about and professing. But if you got people hooked... and kind of do almost anything, you know, it's a really interesting look at it. Since we're on this topic and before we wrap up, I just wanted to throw this out there for anyone who wants to look at this. Obviously the Kamari doc, I think I've seen it. It rings a bell, but I'm going to go back and watch it. Mm-hmm. Have you watched The Righteous Gemstones on Max on HBO?
No, I have not.
It's a comedy. And it basically follows around, a religious family that's of a mega church.
But it's I've got to see that.
It's hilarious. Yeah. And okay. It just shows how much it just plays on all of the stereotypes completely. It's in the same folks who did Eastbound and Down and Vice Principals. It's the same sort of cast. It's very good, but also, as being a comedy, I think it is somewhat eye-opening to people, and I think it makes some people very, very uncomfortable who get so invested in some of those areas because it points out just the hypocrisy at the level that it exists in some of these organizations. Not all, but some.
Yeah, the danger. It sounds right up my alley. I will definitely watch that.
I think you'll enjoy.
Yeah.
The latest true crime stories, expert breakdowns, and shocking twists all in one place. Press subscribe now to the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playmcd.com for full details and amoe.playmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.